colleagues. Out of respect for everyone's time, and there's still a lot of daylight left, we can go ahead and get started. So thank you for joining us today for another webinar in the Montgomery County Medical Society's Rapid Response Series, which we began at the onset of COVID-19 in our community. Since early March, your medical society has been dedicated to helping physicians navigate the challenges of COVID-19 on their practices, and most importantly, on our patients. We've held many webinars to keep physicians informed and produce comprehensive resources for all physicians, including the Practice Reopening Toolkit, which can be found at montgomerymedicine.org. So tonight is a continuation of this commitment to keeping you informed about the changing landscape of COVID-19. And it's our privilege to partner with Dr. Travis Gales, Chief Health Officer for Montgomery County, for the second of our biweekly calls to keep you updated on the status of COVID in our community. Just a few housekeeping items before we begin. Please visit Montgomery County Medical Society's website. That's montgomerymedicine.org, and MedKai's website, medkai.org. You can access the many resources which are constantly updated there. We encourage you to participate in the Dr. Half calls, which have been helpful to keeping informed about COVID in the state of Maryland. The link to participate in these calls can be found in the email that you receive from MedKai. So we'll move on to tonight's discussion, and we welcome Dr. Travis Gales to provide a dashboard of what is happening in Montgomery County and to help us navigate caring for our patients in this most unusual time. You can pose questions via the Zoom chat, and I'll try my best to try to incorporate that. Some of those questions may be answered by Dr. Gales as he's presenting, so we'll look at those at the end of the call. But in any case, Dr. Gales, thank you for joining us tonight. Please.
No problem. Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Since I spent a lot of my time doing canned presentations on data, I welcome the opportunity to have conversations. So I won't spend a lot of time rehashing information that's already there and open up to questions and conversation with you all. Since we met a couple of weeks ago, we have posted our dashboard of the metrics that we continue to use to guide our decisions. I will say this, and as you know, since then, we also have moved to phase one of reopening on this past Monday. And phase one includes creating provisions for curbside retail, outdoor restaurant use, increased opportunity for outdoor sports camps for kids, outdoor day camps for kids, the return of manufacturing, the return of personal services, limited to hair type services, no nails, and no massages and no tattoos. And that is our phase one that is consistent with the phase one of Prince George's County, District of Columbia, as well as the majority of the Northern Virginia counties that are part of the National Capital Region. It's important to note that that does not necessarily match up with what the governor's phase one is or what the governor's phase two that he has announced earlier today that the state will move forward on Friday. I want to really reiterate the reason why we are different from how the governor is moving is because our epidemiology and surveillance data are very different. And there are parts of Maryland that have significantly lower cases and have not been impacted as significantly as we have been in Montgomery County and the National Capital Region. It's important to also highlight that the Northern Virginia counties are in a similar situation where the governor of Virginia has announced moving to phase two, but has allowed those counties to move forward and make decisions that are more consistent with their epidemiology and surveillance. So we continue to monitor our metrics. We have moved forward and made significant improvements. We do have some areas of concern that we are continuing to work on, namely hospital capacity. For those of you who do work in the county hospitals, I'm sure you can acknowledge that hospital volume is still fairly high. And even though we have seen some periodic improvements, particularly as it relates to intensive care capacity, we still are running pretty high. And so to that end, we have been working, we've been pushing the state actually to get the Washington and Venice campus in Tacoma Park up to speed, which would add 200 beds that would significantly improve acute bed capacity, which would also free up capacity for intensive care space and critical care space at the two Adventist campuses throughout the county. We also have been continuing to work with other jurisdictions in terms of gentlemen's agreement, so to speak, and for diversion of cases in order to be able to provide additional capacity and support in areas that have not been as impacted and not running as high in terms of capacity. We are continuing to work to expand our testing capacity. We are finalizing the details on our high throughput testing option with Advogenics that has been announced that will involve a self-collection kit. In the meantime, we are going to be launching a mobile testing apparatus. We had hoped to have that this week. However, we are finalizing the details with the agency who will be working with us to be able to provide those services. Now, by a mobile testing arm, what I mean by that is being able to provide pop-up testing at different venues, particularly located in areas that have been deemed to be hotspots, and being able to provide potentially access to testing without a referral or an appointment. So those are the kinds of things that we are working on, again, to build testing. We have tested more residents than anyone in any jurisdiction in the state. We've tested over nearly 5.5% of our population, which is approximately 65,000 individuals. As we have increased capacity over the last 2 weeks, our test positivity has continued to decrease. And now our 7-day average is approximately 12.7%, which is down significantly from over 35% where it was about 6 to 8 weeks ago. So we continue to look at our measures and metrics. I will emphasize that while we continue to see improvements, before we move to a phase two, we need to see significant decreases in the number of our new cases, because the activities that we're including in phase two would be a lot more points of contact and introducing opportunities for folks to come into contact with others. So we want to drive down as best as possible the number of virus, and the capacity of the virus within our community to minimize potential transmission points. So those are the things that we've been working on. The county is also working on, while we are continuing to be in the response phase, the county has also launched a major recovery effort that includes all of the different government agencies, including the school system, everyone from HR to recreation, transportation, housing, etc. And they have multidisciplinary teams to address all of the different components related to recovery response. And those efforts are moving along simultaneously with our response efforts in public health and emergency preparedness. And a number of those efforts and initiatives have been announced on a county level. And all of this information is available at the county website, the coronavirus website. In addition, we continue to release information related to race and ethnicity, but for fatalities. When we haven't put it up on the website, but we have been able to capture race and ethnicity for approximately 50% of the cases. And we do see a higher percentage of cases in the Latino community, while we continue to see a significantly higher rate of fatalities in the Black community within Montgomery County. I will stop there. Happy to answer any questions that you all have. I will also add one other update. I remember that Susan included in questions. In our last conversation, I did mention that we were creating an advisory board. We are reaching out to individuals, and Dr. Pham and Susan have identified a representative from the Medical Society who will be a part of that conversation. And the goal of that group is to provide, some additional thoughts and input as we continue to move forward, looking at our metrics and making sure that we are looking at the right things and things continue to move forward in the right direction, and also be able to provide opportunities to learn from other best practices in other jurisdictions to help guide drive our response as well as our recovery response as we move forward. I'll stop there and happy to answer any questions. Thank you again for the opportunity to meet with you all.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Gales. a lot of information there. And before we go on to the other questions, I know that there were some other questions from the general membership, but I wanted to share with you hot off the presses with our members. And I think we sent to you a survey recently. Montgomery County Medical Society sent out a survey to over 1,500 physicians regarding the implications of COVID-19 on practices. And I just wanted to highlight some of the results and share it with the people on the call, kind of, like I said, hot off the presses. But some of the notable results included 63.1% of the respondents have no current capacity for COVID-19 testing, 62.1% do not have what they need to attest to readiness to reopen as prescribed in the secretary's order. 83.3% need masks, while 62.5% need gowns. Over 70% note that COVID-19 has had a severe impact on their practices, including 81% seen greater than a 50% decrease in the pre-COVID patient volume. 17% practices have not received stimulus funds. 75% respondents expect major changes in their practices, whether it's closing or joining or being bought out, private equity. 41% of the respondents are experiencing a very high level of professional stress. And so some of the things that we wanted to highlight or talk about really and ask you what you thought when Dr. Half and others say physicians have adequate testing capability and practices or access to PPE. And we wanted to give you an idea of the landscape of what's going on in Montgomery County. Just wondering how their information is validated to be able to make such statements, and what resources can we make available to our physicians, all of the members and non-members, to be able to reopen? Because now that we're talking about reopening, we want people to feel safe coming in, but we're not able to do that unless we have all the things in place. So I was hoping you could address that.
Sure. Well, all of those things are, excuse me, things that we're aware of. Now, how we fix it, I think, is a larger issue. We, for example, in terms of, I think one of the questions was about, you know, how to get partitions and things like that. Now, the county doesn't have the bandwidth to be able to provide all of that for everyone. However, I know that our staff, if folks do have PPE needs, I would encourage you to, we have an online form that's part of the county emergency preparedness site that folks can complete and request PPE. Again, I can't promise that it will be a ton, but let us know, please send that in, and our team will try as best as possible to be able to make provisions to provide some resources to you in terms of supplies, but then also helping connect you with other resources that may be able to provide that type of equipment. I think if I recall correctly, our county procurement team has created a site where they are actually selling PPE at cost, as opposed to the exorbitant markups that some of you probably have experienced when you've gone to other sites. It's been interesting. I get all of these emails from sites saying, everybody's got PPE. And it's interesting. I'm like, well, where is everybody getting it from? Particularly when the cost. I can think of one of the hospitals who had a severe shortage of isolation gowns, and we were helping identify places to have them. And one place was charging, I think, $20 a gown, which, you know, is absolutely ridiculous given the regular wholesale price. So I say all of that to say that please complete that form, send that in to our public health emergency preparedness team, and they will also help direct you in terms of being able to potentially supply you with a starter amount of resources, but help connect you with others to get those types of resources. I think this creates a great opportunity to partner with the medical society in terms of, again, how to best get that messaging out to providers within the community, in terms of whether it's through webinars, a PR campaign, you know, an email blast with links. You know, certainly we're open to ideas to figure out how to do that, because if we don't have a robust healthcare system to provide the services that we need, we're going to be in trouble to not only take care of the COVID-related illnesses, but we all know that other healthcare stuff hasn't stopped in the midst of COVID. So we've got to get people into the doctor to get the resources that they need for those other illnesses that they may have postponed because of fears of COVID, to get those addressed. I will provide an update in terms of immunizations. I know that the state AAP chapter has sent a letter to the governor. I chair the State Immunization Commission, and we will be sending information to the governor to recommend that as part of the recovery process, that there is consideration for making sure there's encouragement for parents and folks to get their vaccines and get up to date and caught up. And particularly as we move in the fall with the flu vaccine, as well, if we do have a COVID vaccine available, that we have the infrastructure to mass disseminate it to the public.
Great. Just a follow-up comment. I think I saw a question on the chat here where the online application didn't have any gowns or head covers or N95s. I don't know if this was a recent application where they were not able to find this, but I just want to point out that certainly if you're not able to procure some of these PPE from the online form, and we can post that on montgomerymedicine.org. I think the form is listed there to your site, to the county site. But I think that there is a partnership working out with a relationship with Handcraft for gowns and other items. So I think Susan mentioned that there. And then as far as some of the points that you hit about the immunizations, MCMS has an immunization task force. We have an ad hoc task force, and kind of anticipating even just flu vaccines and even what's going to be coming through with COVID-19. How can we help you? Is this something that, you know, you want to get members to gain information and then meet, or how can we help you collaboratively?
Well, I think the big thing is getting the information out to the public, because I know providers are ready to do it. You know, even in our own immunization program, we're kind of waiting for things to you know, as we move forward, make provisions. So I would say, I think, again, it creates the opportunity to think about how, you know, we can do something outside the box or creative. If that's, you know, I'm not the most social media savvy person, but I hear it works. You know, so I think we can, what would be beneficial to us is, again, the opportunity to just increase the bandwidth to get that message out. So I think we can continue to talk through that, what that might look like. Certainly from a public health perspective, we're an open book, you know, whatever is the most effective measure to get the word out, in terms of how we can support you all doing that. We're open to it.
That's great. And going back then to just a segue then for social media, I think we were talking about uniform messaging with regards to out to the public and saying that, yes, it is safe to come into medical practices. I know there's an infographic out there that goes out to the public and saying, yes, retail is here, salon hair, not nail salons, but hair places are open and you can do curbside and delivery. And there's also like little icons. Is there a way to include healthcare on there? I can tell you as an otolaryngologist, I recently had a patient I was called on that patient didn't come to the hospital for several days. I mean, didn't seek care and then ended up in the hospital with an abscess that required surgical intervention. And then when I asked, did this patient fail outpatient therapy? And she said, I was too afraid to come in. Sure. She was young. She had a mitral valve replacement though, so she was concerned. So I think it was one of those situations where the messaging is that the hospitals and the emergency rooms, that's another part of it, not just medical practices. So I don't know if there's an opportunity there to kind of work on that infographic or notation about being able to pursue healthcare there.
Sure. So the short answer is yes. And the longer answer is I'll make sure that the communications team is aware of that and they can add, since they do all the graphics, but they can make provisions for that. Certainly.
Okay. Well, that's great. And then I think we're addressing a lot of There's a lot of chats, comments in here. So I think many people are offering information. So I think that there's some questions that you can look through the chat. I mean, the members, as far as where to get some plexiglass. But I really, what's been weighing heavily, you know, for me, and it's a burden recently, is, you know, I just wanted to address that certainly the traumatic events of everything that's happening past few months, the pandemic, so isolation, you know, economic uncertainty and turmoil, combined with now everything that's taking place across, you know, the nation. As physicians, we should be not just healers in our communities, but leaders. And, you know, everything that's going on, and we're recognizing the plight of our fellow Americans, and it's weighing heavy on me. And we talk about social determinants of health and health inequalities and everything. And in Montgomery County, we are seeing people being moved to support the national movement and trying to, I know we can't solve everything in this one call, but I would like to ask you, what do you feel our role is as physicians now? And what can Montgomery County Medical Society do as a group for you and physicians? Where can we help the county and partner with you with regards to addressing all of these things that are going on in the media at this time?
Sure, that's an excellent question. And I think that's the reality that is hitting a lot of us. You know, I have a nightly check-in with friends to be like, okay, particularly because everyone's still having to go to work and having to be present and having to, you know, focus and fight all of the things that you mentioned, but also deal with your own personal trauma and your own personal feelings about what's happening and what's going on. And so I think the first thing that we can all do, and as cliche as this sounds, is to actually take care of ourselves and our families. I think that's the first and most important thing, and making sure that if you have issues or concerns or strong feelings about things, that you have opportunities and outlets to be able to talk about those things and discuss those things. Because we, you know, all of us on the call, I don't think any of us really, if you did, I'm jealous, but I don't remember a course in medical school or through residency that taught you how to kind of deal with stuff, as opposed to, okay, toughen up, you know, you have your moment, you'll get through it, and you'll get to the other side. So I think that's a big priority for us, because we as physicians, as you mentioned, we have to carry the weight of everyone else's trauma, whether we're seeing them in a behavioral health setting, we're seeing them when they come in. So for example, the patient you mentioned, you're providing care to her, that patient, and you're solving their clinical care, but they were concerned, they were afraid to come in. And so you're dealing with those kind of things. So that said, I think the other things that are important. So from the public health perspective, we have been pushing, and we actually had some conversations in the fall. So had COVID not happened, we could have moved forward with these things, but it creates the opportunity now to do so, is how we look at how we do chronic disease management. For example, we are launching, or we were working on launching, a significant effort in terms of type 2 diabetes. As some of you general practice folks may know, the State Department of Health has made type 2 diabetes one of its signature issues, and has dedicated a lot of resources in terms of how to manage that. We have committed from the health department's perspective is investing in our population health program that, as you mentioned, is actively looking at social determinants of health. So the four pillars of our Healthy Montgomery program, for those of you who may have heard of it or may not have heard of it, that's our population health-based program. It's a partnership with the hospitals and health systems in the county, different government agencies, our minority health program and initiatives, the school system, and community members. And the four principles are using epi and surveillance data to drive public health decision-making, access to care, review of social determinants of health, and health equity. And those are the principles that we use for that program, and also the principles that we use across all of the different programs and divisions of public health services. So I see it as an opportunity to partner with the medical society to continue to lead the conversations around social determinants of health. I'll be perfectly candid. I think one of the issues that we struggle with here in Montgomery County is that anytime there are situations that happen across the country or we see disparate outcomes in other places, we often are thought to be the golden, we're thought to have no problems here. Is the easiest way to say it. And so it makes it tricky sometimes when we have to engage and talk about disparities, because a lot of people are like, well, I didn't know we had that here. And so we continue, from our perspective, we continue to drive that. We continue to put out reports that do highlight spaces where there are disparities by geography, gender, race, ethnicity, et cetera. And so I see the Medical Society as a great partner in terms of taking that work to the next level in terms of being able to hold those conversations with patients, hold those conversations with our communities, and hold those conversations with our elected leaders.
Thank you for addressing that. I know that that's one thing that I was looking to just sort of get feedback on, but I definitely want to try to get some of the other questions answered. I know we were talking about COVID. I think that there are some questions here in the chat with a specific concern with regards to staff. Now, has everybody been testing, doing COVID-19 antibody testing for staff? Is that indicated? I think that's very, I think there's some controversy there. It's not mandatory.
No one's mandated it, and we continue, we along with most other health departments actually across the state, we're continuing to think about how to best leverage antibody tests. Mm-hmm. And the big issue is, you know, the sensitivity and specificity, and in particular, the positive predictive value of the test remains a little bit quirky. And so, you know, we've got to see improvements on those statistics before we go out and, you know, we mandate folks to use it. I think there is some potential utility, certainly, in the test. It's just unclear right now how to best use it. And so, for example, if I get a test and I've got evidence of it, does that mean I'm completely cleared to come back to work? Do I get an immunity passport to travel? You know, which would be nice because I'm looking to travel. But anyway, no. Jokes aside, but it's how do we use it? And I think that's the question we're still waiting to see.
And a follow-up to that, someone had asked whether or not the antibody testing was free. They're quite expensive. I hadn't heard that there was anybody that was covering antibody testing, or have you heard otherwise?
I know some of the larger, the private labs, I know LabCorp and Quest are offering antibody. It's a venipuncture antibody test. And from some of the conversations, because we've explored it, I'll be perfectly candid, we've been looking at for probably about the last 2 months, you know, do we stand something like that up in the county and who do we partner with? And we haven't made the decision to move forward in that direction. But I do, in some of those conversations, I feel like that the labs have said that some of the insurance programs do provide coverage. I know that the insurers are providing coverage for the PCR testing. I'm not as confident in the antibody test coverage.
Have we seen anything change with regards to antigen testing and any progress on that?
Well, I think the big changes is again, unfortunately, much like the antibody test, is everything had to move quickly. So there was a rush to get everything moved forward, you know, and get these emergency clearances. And, you know, I've looked at some studies, validation studies for some of these things where the validation sample was like 100. And so, you know, historically, typically we spend a little bit more time confirming and validating these platforms and different things like that. But in the interest to try to put things out, we haven't necessarily, and I say we, but you know, FDA hasn't had necessarily had the full time to do that. I say all of that to say that we continue to study and learn what are the best modalities. There is a significant push to create, again, less invasive testing measures that are going to be allowed to do high throughput testing. For example, the measure that we are looking to add to our high throughput testing would be an oral collection kit. It would be a swab. And I know that the same lab is already looking at how you could use a saliva collection kit where you just spit into a receptacle. That's it. So I think that's probably The two paths that are going are looking at less invasive testing modalities, as well as modalities that can do rapid response, so you're not waiting 24, 48, 72 hours for your results.
So speaking of testing, though, in general, it certainly is encouraging to hear that the numbers went from 3.5% to 5% as far as it had been tested. Do you know if that includes what's been tested in the private? Do the CVSs in Montgomery County report those numbers to the county? Does that include all the preoperative COVID testing as well, those numbers?
So it actually
with the private sector?
It includes anyone who has tested who has a Montgomery County zip code or address in the system on the requisition form. So what happens is when you get your test, whatever address is on your requisition form is that goes into the state system, and then we as the local health department pull all of the results, both positive and negative, for any of those tests that are part of our jurisdiction. So the 5.5% is representative of any of the tests within the county. So we're talking private sector, any of those that we have tested in the public sector, nursing homes, individuals, the whole spectrum.
I see. Okay. So then as a follow-up to that, how is the contact tracing work? How many of those do you have in place? And are you actively looking for more people to be contact tracers, or is it an electronic thing you're doing, or just people actually physically calling? Who's doing the
So we have been doing contact tracing in some form since the very beginning. And it's really interesting. I can think back to in March where we were, we had our first few cases and we were moving along and we were able to track really, I actually sat in on some of those interviews, and obviously the volume has significantly increased. And so the state actually has created a statewide system where they invested and hired over 1,000 contact tracers to create a state system that has a shared electronic platform that each of the local health departments can access. So what happens is, and that system is going live this week, all of our disease control staff, as well as our contact tracers, we currently have approximately 80 contact tracers, including disease control, who are working on this. They've all been trained on the new system. Now that that system is in place, we are also going to be hiring a host of contact tracers through the contract agency, because we recognize this is going to be a long-term haul. This is consistent with Baltimore and D.C. and Prince George's County. But then there's also the room for volunteers to be able to come in and support those efforts. So if there are folks who are interested in volunteering, I think I shared the volunteer coordinator's information last time. That is Jessica Pryor. Her email is jessica.pryor@montgomerycountymd.gov. And we've had a number of those folks go through the Medical Reserve Corps to get everything confirmed and be able to come in. So that's the process. The great thing about the state system is they have committed to covering at least the first 1,000 cases on a daily basis and contacting individuals within 24 hours of when their result hits the system.
So some other questions. I think on the chat here, Dr. Schwartz asked about college students becoming contact tracers. So we'll put in the chat Jessica Pryor's email, or have a follow-up message about how to contact her. Now, a couple of other advanced questions were, what should we expect for, I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what should we expect for the upcoming school year for MCPS? How should we prepare and reassure parents about with this MIS, the syndrome, as we enter into phase one of reopening? How has the reopening been? It's only been 2 days. I don't know if I can comment on, any thoughts on that, the fall?
I'll take that question first. So it has been 2 days. What's been interesting is there were some that thought, for example, with restaurants reopening in terms of outdoor capacity, they thought that they would be full. They haven't been. And this is actually consistent with surveys across the country that have shown that people are still reticent about coming out. It's like, yes, it's things are open, but there are a lot of people saying, you know what, I'm okay at home. I want to see how things progress a little bit before I feel comfortable coming out. And it's so the same phenomena that you talked about in terms of people accessing medical care for, you know, being concerned, is we're seeing that spell out into other areas. Now, we recognize that every part of the state is different. For example, when about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, the state opened up, there were lots of people who went to the beach, and there were lots of people who were in those areas. You know, I think it's different for those of us who live in jurisdictions where the numbers have been higher. I think, you know, we were talking before the call started, you know, our press conference where we reopened things was a little bit controversial. We had a few protesters there who were not happy about the approach we've taken. But the overwhelming majority and the feedback that we've received is that people have appreciated using a data-driven approach that is a little bit more methodical and thoughtful in terms of how we reopen so that they feel safer. Now, to pivot back to the other question in terms of when will schools open? And how will they open? I don't have all of those specific details, but suffice to say that we do work closely with Montgomery County Public Schools in terms of providing guidance from a public health perspective. They have been partners from the very beginning, from before, back in February, before we had any cases, in terms of being prepared to provide services to their students. I do know that they are working closely with the State Department of Education in terms of thinking through different strategies. I would imagine a lot of the ability to reopen in the fall will be contingent upon how we move through the summer. And, you know, when people ask, well, you know, well, what can we do to get to phase two and how do we move forward? Do what we're asking you to do in terms of the public health practices. So even when you're going out wearing your face covering, practicing physical distancing and minimizing your contact points with others, if we can drive the numbers down and avoid a second spike later on in the summer and the trend continues to flatten out and go closer to zero, I think that does open up the opportunity where schools would be open. I know, for example, the former Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, gave a webinar, it's been probably about over a month ago, that talked about how schools will probably implement some alternative strategies, such as, you know, continuing with distance learning, but maybe having students, to alleviate capacity concerns, having students come in shifts. So, you know, maybe alternate days, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, stuff, you know, that kind of thing. Now, I'm not saying that's what MCPS is going to do. What I can emphasize, though, is that they're looking at all potential options and opportunities to be able to provide services.
Okay. Well, that's a conservative viewpoint. So I think we have some practice-specific questions with regards to with opening, like how often to change gowns and face masks and face shields needed, and what kind of cleaning on fabric covered chairs in a consultation room. And changing and cleaning the BP cuffs. I don't know if you have any standard recommendation, but I know that that question was out there from at least a couple physicians.
Well, I think, I don't have an exhaustive catalog in my head of all those. I would say, you know, I would refer to the CDC guidance in terms of those things. And that probably would allow for, you know, the researcher's specific question. I think every situation is very different. And so, you know, from a blanket perspective, most of the cleaning mechanisms that we have in place, you know, our standard traditional cleaning techniques are effective against COVID. And so it's more of a how often are you cleaning as opposed to, you know, are you using some heavy duty type cleaning agent? So those are the kinds of things that I think, you know, one has to think about when they're reopening. I think many of those questions about infection control with patients, I think are standard for any type of infectious contact. So again, I would not to dismiss the question, I would refer you to the CDC guideline so that you could get the specific information for the specific question.
Yes, I echo that as well, because I know that there was another question on the chat from an individual solo practitioner. Mm-hmm. If they had been exposed to a positive COVID positive patient, should the office close and the staff continue to see patient with face shield and face mask, especially if no obvious symptoms? And I would echo Dr. Gales in saying that the CDC, you can correct me, but the CDC guidelines with regards to return to work and depends on what type of exposure, if they were low risk versus high risk, if they're wearing a mask, and if the practitioner themselves were even wearing any mask versus the patient themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think we can post that and refer you back, the person in the chat, physician member on the chat, refer you back to the montgomerymedicine.org site. It talks about that as well. And I think there are some other questions about insurance. I know we're all moving towards telehealth. Do we have an idea of whether or not these televisits are still being, are we still in a state of public health emergency that we're still getting these covered at the same level of office visits?
Yeah, I can't speak to the individual providers, but I can attest to you, we are still in a public health emergency. In fact, before this call, so as even though the governor announced moving to phase two, his executive order also extended the public health emergency. So that provision is still in place. And given that, as best as my understanding is that insurance companies would still be covering telemedicine type procedures and provisions.
Okay. And I just wanted to acknowledge Susan was notifying everyone here on the chat that we did actually have an OSHA webinar today, which was related to bloodborne pathogens and such. And it's the closest OSHA guidelines that are available to COVID. So that webinar will be on the MCMS website. So physicians can refer to that as well. I'm sorry. There's a doctor who is not muted. If you would mind muting Carissa or Susan, if you can find that. Thank you.
There we go.
Yeah, thank you. So we'll go ahead and open the lines for questions. I know that people on Zoom have been asking some questions through the chat, but if you're on your phone, you can hit star six and ask your question and remute yourself by hitting star six again, but please announce who you are and you can ask your question to Dr. Gales.
Everything's been answered.
Okay. Well, there was one follow-up. I think one of our physicians was asking, can you repeat how to get the contact tracers again? I just want to make sure.
So if there are folks interested, and again, I can't say that everyone who sends in and asks to volunteer will be a part of the system. But if you are interested, the volunteer coordinator is Jessica Pryor. In fact, actually, I'll type it in the chat. So I'll type her email in the chat feature as opposed to saying it out loud. That'll probably be easier for everybody.
So I think that there hasn't been any other questions that I've seen thus far. Thank you for putting that in the chat, Dr. Gales.
No problem.
And anybody else on the call, any other questions? I think you covered everything so far, at least as of today, a lot actually.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, thank you for this webinar. It's really helpful. Just wanted to check, how can the public be made aware of the adverse effects of wearing masks for prolonged amounts of time, such as them getting decreased oxygen and more carbon dioxide and the increased number of people becoming sick and their immune system being suppressed, or they getting sick from their own bacteria from wearing masks for prolonged amount of time, especially when they're outside? It's understandable if it's for a brief amount of time in a closed setting, such as a physician's office, but when they're out in public walking around, a lot of people are becoming sick. So how could you make the public aware of this adverse effects of wearing masks for a long amount of times?
So I confess I'm not aware of a large amount of folks getting sick from wearing them. What we do have is on our information that we have about, you know, safely wearing masks is, you know, links to, you know, the CDC guidance and information resources that will probably go into more detail about those risks. Now, we certainly do forewarn folks that, you know, particularly those who have breathing difficulty or illnesses that make it difficult to breathe or respiratory issues, that they have to be careful with the mask because it can compromise your ability to breathe effectively. But beyond that, I'm not aware. We don't post anything per se from the county site. We, you know, we link to different information resources that can provide that additional guidance. But I will look into it.
Great. Thank you for the question. Are there any other questions? That's great. Well, we thank you, Dr. Gales, for being with us and for your insights and expertise. Your presentation and our candid dialogue here has been very helpful. We thank you for continuing to partner with us and be with us on this update. So we look forward to the next one in 2 weeks, Wednesday, June 17th. So maybe some more updates will be there. Sure. And lastly, I just wanted to say, you know, remember MCMS and MedCHI are here for you. So please get in touch if we can assist you with any questions you may have. I wanted to echo Dr. Gales. We encourage you to take care of yourself so you can take care of your patients. And I appreciate your time, everyone being with us. So thank you. Good evening. Good night.